Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Today is Tuesday, and so that means we start with news from the citrus industry. Researchers at Texas A&M AgriLife are working with scientists from the University of Maryland and the USDA on improving crop defenses against diseases. Through a combination of CRISPR and gene editing technology, researchers are working to develop disease-resistant citrus fruits. The team also hopes to make breakthroughs in crop regeneration. Currently, only a small number of plant species respond well to techniques that involve cell culturing, which is growing cells outside the plant in a suitable environment, though the reasons for this are unclear to the researchers. Even among the crops that regenerate, the process poses risks. Regeneration also takes a long time, forcing researchers to predict which crops and traits will be in demand years in advance. Researchers want to create citrus varieties that are resistant to Huanglongbing. Mexico's citrus exports through August this year increased by 28% year-on-year, reaching a total value of more than $912 million. That according to the Mexican Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development. The main destination for Mexican citrus fruits is the U.S., followed by the Netherlands, Japan, Germany, and the U.K. Mexican citrus represented more than 78% of imports for the U.S. of citrus fruits. Mexico is the world's second largest exporter of limes, with almost 18% of the world sales volume. It's the fourth world producer of grapefruit. The Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service is revising the entry requirements for citrus fruit from two districts in Australia. The revision is necessary because both those districts no longer meet the requirements to be considered fruit fly-free areas for Queensland fruit fly. The action applies to the importation of several fresh citrus species, including grapefruit, lemons, limes, mandarins, oranges, and tangelos. APHIS is now requiring in-transit cold treatment for those citrus varieties when originating from those areas. That is our citrus news for today. News from the rest of the ag industry is up next. We will be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Here's your news brief for today. It's a busy week in Washington, D.C., with a tight deadline for continuing resolutions and the U.S. debt ceiling, along with a planned infrastructure vote in the House of Representatives. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had promised an infrastructure vote by Monday, but told House members late last week that the debate would begin early in the week with a likely vote on Thursday. The infrastructure package passed the Senate in August. It is expected to help fund road, bridge, water infrastructure, and other projects. Pelosi told Reuters over the weekend, "We are now working together with the Senate and the White House on changes to this historic legislation." Pelosi said she would not bring the infrastructure bill to a vote until she was sure it would pass, but expressed confidence about its prospects. Some House Democrats have threatened to vote against the bill, instead favoring the larger $3.5 trillion version of that bill. Over the long haul, people who buy farms can expect them to return between 10 and 11% on their investment. Still, as Todd Gleason reports, that probably will take a couple of decades.
Now, farmers live poor and die rich. Most in agriculture have heard this old adage and understand it. It rings true because, as University of Illinois Extension agricultural economist Gary Schnittke explains, the return from a farm comes in two forms, and the liquid one doesn't really cover the cost of ownership.
Yeah, so if you look at the what makes up returns, there's two parts of it. The current return, which is for farmland cash rent, or the return from what farmers get in farming it, and then there's capital gain. And the capital gain is the change in the farmland price over time.
It used to be that the split between these two income sources, the return from farming the farm, or the current liquid cash return, and the return from the investment in the farm, or the capital gain, was about equal. That's no longer the case, and it makes it really hard to finance buying a farm, says Schnittke.
Over time, the current return has been decreasing. It has averaged over the 1970 through 2021 period 5%, and now it's down to 3%.
In practice, this declining annual income portion of owning the farm, the part you get from selling the crop, is not enough to service the debt or the mortgage on the farm unless the down payment was bigger than 50% of the purchase price.
So that comes back sort of the old adage that farmers live poor and die rich. And part of the reason why that is because, you know, if you're buying land, you have to find alternative other sources to finance that farmland.
Well, the end result, says Gary Schnittke, is that farmland is a good asset, returning 10 to 11% over the long run, but that the entry cost, it's really high. I'm Todd Gleason.
The Department of Agriculture will invest nearly $75 million for 15 partner-led projects to address natural resource concerns on private lands. This year, projects funded by the Regional Conservation Partnership Program's alternative funding arrangements focus on climate-smart agriculture and forestry and other conservation priorities and improve access to historically underserved producers. Swine, chicken, and turkey producers who suffer losses from a lack of access to processing facilities during the pandemic now have more time to sign up for a USDA pandemic assistance program, Rod Bain reports. Longtime Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, at 88 years old, will seek re-election in 2022. Grassley is the oldest Republican in the Senate, and if elected, his next term will end when he is 95. In addition to the decision, Grassley says, Iowans have encouraged him to continue his work representing them. One number in Friday's USDA Cattle on Feed report may have given some analysts a mild surprise. Gary Crawford reports.
Going into Friday's USDA report on cattle feedlot activity,
industry analysts were expecting about a 1% decline in placements during August.
What they got was a placement number of 2.1 million head, which was up 2% from a year ago. Agriculture Department livestock analyst Shale Shagham says looking at the geography, placements were down in states like Texas and Oklahoma, where forage has been available.
But it tends to be up in some of those northern tier states where they've been experiencing drought.
August marketings of fed cattle were down some, leaving feedlots on September 1st with an 11.2 million head inventory, but Shagham says,
although it is down from last year's record, it still remains the second highest September 1st number since the series began in 1996.
USDA's benchmark steer price right now is running about 103 a hundredweight. It was 105 this time a year ago.
So this does support some of that tightening that we have seen occurring since last year.
USDA has been forecasting a small decline in herd size and in beef production next year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
U.S. restaurants feeling supply chain issues for their food products are also contending with issues around upgrading kitchen equipment. Restaurant Business reports it can sometimes take months to get equipment in the door, thanks to a backlog of imports that has left 24 or more container ships waiting outside of U.S. ports. Case IH has a new vertical tillage tool in its soil management lineup. Michael Clements has details.
Chris Larson, tillage marketing manager at Case IH, says the new VT Flex 435 vertical tillage tool is all about giving operators on-the-go adjustment options to better manage their soil while out in the field.
As we've gone and asked customers about what they're looking for and what they want kind of in that seedbed pass or that vertical tillage pass, it comes down to flexibility and productivity and give me something durable. First and foremost, it really gives us that ability to complement those variability needs that they want by using variable gang angle adjustment. Also gives us simple and easy depth control. We can go from 1 to 4 inches with the tool. And finally, sizing and giving that finish out the back as the Tiger Paw Crumbler.
Larson says the VT Flex 435 vertical tillage tool is ideal for mixed farms and small to mid-sized grain operations.
Whether it be fall use, spring use, corn stalks, soybean stubble, wheat stubble, you name it, it has that kind of capability to go into those conditions. The overall tool itself is able to adjust and give you that output that you're looking for from a vertical tillage tool. Whether it be needing to size residue, preserve the soil, or to mix that residue in, it has that capability. It's really for those mixed livestock to grain operations, and then the small to mid-sized grain farmers alone. Offered from 11 feet, has a very unique size in that 15 that actually folds, gets us down the road quicker, and then all the way up to 25.
Additionally, on-the-go adjustments help producers make the most of their time with this tillage tool.
Time is always of the essence. We know that, and we would rather be running than making adjustments to the tool. So we offer this VT Flex 435 available with hydraulic gang angle adjustments, so we're able to make adjustments quickly, efficiently, and also be able to evaluate the agronomics as we're making those adjustments, making sure that we're getting out of the tool what we want. One unique thing that will also help save some time is we have an in-cab adjustment to switch between front gangs and rear gangs adjustment. So you can make those individual adjustments all the way from 0 to 12 degree gang angle.
Larson says the VT Flex 435 vertical tillage tool is also designed to be durable.
The 20-inch earth metal VT wave blades are kind of the standard in the industry as far as ruggedness and durability. It also gives us a flat spot to mate our cast iron nodular spools against. And using 1.5-inch long arbor bolts, we crimp the entire gang together once and only once because we have all these flat surfaces that mount together. The Tiger Paw Crumbler, of course, has spring down pressure to it, simple and easy to adjust, but also uses that formed bar that gives us that action of a flat bar, ruggedness of a round bar. And then finally, making sure this machine stays good looking throughout its life, we use a powder coat paint adhesion system that allows that machine to be resistant to impact, scratching, fading, and keeps that resale value into the future.
You can order the VT Flex 435 vertical tillage tool this fall and take delivery next year.
So the VT Flex 435 is available for order starting here in October of 2021, and we'll have them built and available for use in the fall of 2022. If you want to learn more about the VT Flex 435, certainly reach out, contact your local Case IH dealer, or head over to caseih.com to learn more.
Again, visit with your Case IH dealer to learn more or head to caseih.com. Michael Clements reporting.
That's our news for today. Taylor Chalstrom is up next. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, this is Taylor with My Ag Life. We wrapped up our annual Crop Consultant Conference, and I got the chance to speak with UCCE IPM specialist Kent Dana about his talk at the conference, which discussed biology of and pest management strategies for vine mealybug and grapevines. Here is that interview from the conference. Kent, can you give us a general little overview about vine mealybug first to start off?
Sure. So vine mealybug has become one of the most important pests of vineyards in California. We know it came from the Middle Eastern area, probably Israel. Normally it is from the Mediterranean region. So you can find vine mealybug populations from Spain to France to Italy to Greece. Also in North Africa, Egypt, Israel. Our population is most likely from Israel and most likely came from someone bringing in table grape material from that country. This is why it's so important not to bring in wood that you don't know where it's from.
That is a really good point. I'm curious,
You know, these vine mealybugs, they have this really distinct appearance. It's almost like this white velvety look. Are they really easy to spot out there? Well,
that's what's so funny, is that they're actually not easy to find at the beginning of an infestation. So all the photos that you see are close-up pictures, usually of the adult stages. They've got this wax secretion that covers their body. Each time they molt, they lose that, and they become kind of a slight pinkish or purplish-colored insect. And the crawlers, the first instar stage, is only about a millimeter in size. And so you can get thousands of mealybugs on a vine underneath the bark and not see them at all. It's really when the population gets much larger, where they're starting to secrete so much honeydew, that the growers start to realize the population's there. That's why I like to use pheromone traps. You can see the population building up in the vineyard before you can actually find it clustered on a corner of the vineyard block on five or six vines.
That's really important. And that was one thing you brought up in your presentation a lot, the use of pheromones and mating disruption for this pest. How big of a problem has this pest really been in grapevines, and how can mating disruption be used to kind of mitigate it at this point?
So again, I think, in my opinion, it's the most important insect pest of vineyards right now in California. California is the only state in North America that's got the vine mealybug. Other states, Oregon, Washington, throughout the East Coast, have got the native grape mealybug. So the vine mealybug is an invasive mealybug pest, which is in California, and it really has changed our pest management program. So for example, we just lost lorazepam. Lorazepam was really primarily used for vine mealybug as a delayed dormant. And if you look at crop use reports from Oregon and Washington, you don't see Movento being used very commonly. You never saw lorazepam being used very much. That's because those products and Admire were really focused on this vine mealybug. So it definitely has changed the insecticide use in California, and of course the mating disruption use as well.
You stressed the importance of mating disruption as well as insecticide use kind of in tandem. And you mentioned this study you did where combining two insecticides, kind of a double application, actually seemed to work better, if I'm not mistaken. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so that's another good point from the talk. And it's not so much that in the past, a single insecticide did not work. Years and years ago, when vine mealybug first got into California, when we would put on Admire, a neonicotinoid, through the drip system, we ended up with season-long control. And then slowly, it didn't seem to work quite as well. Then we found Movento, spirotetramat. We put that on as a single application. We got, you know, year-long control. Sometimes we didn't see a mealybug for 2 years. Now growers seem to be going in with more than one insecticide to try to bring the mealybug population down to control. And remember, the mealybug is a vector of grape leaf-associated virus. So in the past, when growers were thinking about control for a cosmetic pest of grapes, now for wine grapes, they're thinking about it as an insect vector. So the tolerance has really decreased. We have to keep the population much lower than we used to consider an economic threshold.
Definitely. And one thing you mentioned about getting that population threshold down, or that population in general, is using insecticides to get it to a level and then implementing a mating disruption to get it to an even lower level than the insecticides can do on their own. You know, how important really is that?
Right, and that's why the combination of insecticides are sometimes useful. There's a lot of good products out there. We've got organophosphate still, some are registered, carbamate still, one is registered, but Movento, the neonicotinoids, the insect growth regulators, these are all great, but we don't want to use one all the time. We want to mix our chemistries to help reduce or slow down the development of resistance. And mating disruption, it's a great tool added to the toolbox, but just think about it. You've got this clumped population of mealybugs. You've got a male emerging as a winged adult male, a little tiny insect. But if the vine has got 1,000 mealybugs and the male has to move 1 inch to find a female, it's going to move 1 inch and find a female.
Yeah.
mating disruption works when the population is so low, the male's got to take flight to find the female two, three, four vines down the way.
Yeah.
And so mating disruption needs to have that population low. It works out great in one way too. Insecticides, we've got a lot of good products. If you've got a high mealybug population and you put on any of the standard materials, you're going to get 90-95% kill or more. But there's still a population that remains. So mating disruption works better at those lower densities. So it works in combination with insecticides. Use insecticides first, mating disruption once you got the population controlled to maintain a low level and to keep moving it lower and lower each year, and then start to use it in combination with some of the good natural enemies like the parasites that work fairly well at low mealybug densities as well.
Yeah, you actually talked about a couple of those biologicals and in your presentation as well. I forget at the moment which specific one you referenced. You put a video of it up on the screen. Can you explain that one and how it's being implemented at the moment? Maybe
sure.
Any of the work that's being done.
So the natural enemies kind of fall out into two groups, predators and parasitoids. Of the predators, there's really two important groups, the green lacewings and the mealybug destroyer, or the beetles. Green lacewing is kind of a light green as an adult, long wings, looks very fragile as it flies. The larvae have got sickle-like mouth parts. And in fact, if you're a Star Trek fan, I think it was the second movie when Sulu had an alien invade his body, and what they showed was a close-up of a green lacewing coming out of Sulu's ear. Instead of doing some kind of great big mechanics, or this was before they did a lot of video alteration with I don't even know what you call it these days.
CGI.
CGI.
Yeah,
this was just a little green lacewing that you can buy from one of the insectaries.
It was literally a green lacewing.
It was literally a green lacewing coming out of Sulu's ear, just a close-up of that. So these predators work fairly well when the mealybug density is somewhat high.
Mm-hmm.
David Haviland's doing a great job now looking at dispersion. My issue with these predator groups is getting it out in the vineyard and spreading it out so the population is still viable, strong, alive, able to kill the mealybug.
Mm-hmm.
The parasite, and the one I work with quite closely, is Anagyrus pseudococci, no common name. You can also purchase it from insectaries. It works a little bit better at mealybugs at lower densities. The issue with all of these is getting it from the insectaries and getting it out to the insect, out to the field in a live, viable condition.
Yeah.
And in fact, we just bought a set of Anagyrus from a European company, and there was 75% mortality when it arrived at our doorstep.
Wow.
So that's still an issue. They're out there naturally in your vineyard. There are things you can do to increase their numbers naturally. Most important thing is to manage your insecticides so you're not using a lot of the broad spectrum contact materials which kill these natural enemies.
That's a good sentiment there. I have another question, kind of related but unrelated. Is this pest, you say it's vine mealybug is specific to California in terms of North America, right?
As an invasive species.
As an invasive
It's only
species.
Been found in California. Oregon, it can get there eventually, so be careful.
And within California, is it really only certain regions or climates that it's in, or is it like extremely widespread within these vineyards?
It's very widespread within California. I don't know that it's in Mendocino yet. In fact, I've been told it's not in Mendocino. Okay. But from Coachella Valley up throughout Napa, Sonoma, throughout the Central Coast, you can find it. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for providing some more information on
sure.
This really seemingly important pest. Hopefully, with David Haviland's work, there will be some things to look forward to in terms of biologicals and hopefully insecticides and mating disruption in the future. Kenneth, thank you for being here today at the Crop Consultant Conference and here with me right now talking about this important subject.
Thank you, Taylor.
Of course.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California.
Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlante is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlante wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
At the recent AgriPulse webinar on sustainable solutions for zero hunger by 2030, Constance Coleman, the president and CEO of the American Feed Industry Association, moderated the Farm-to-Table Transformation Industry Leader Panel. We have the opening part of that panel for you.
It's a pleasure to participate in this important event and this important conversation. Kicked off last year, the UN Food Systems Summit is an important opportunity to have a global conversation about the way we produce food for the billions of people across the planet. As one can see from the very diverse views expressed throughout the process, it's clearly a discussion to which the US food chain has a whole lot to contribute. Responding to the call for input, the private sector immediately engaged to share our experience, our goals, initiatives, and the learnings from our efforts to get to zero hunger by providing more high quality nutrition in a way that conserves our natural resources and supports our local communities. In our conversations, we have learned that our efforts and successes are not well understood, but that the best way to communicate our learnings is to share examples of that success. So today we have two individuals who capture that visionary effort. The first is Eric Jacobson. Eric is Vice President and General Manager of Cattle Operations and is responsible for ranching and feeding operations throughout North America, and also oversees long-term land use planning at Desert Ranches of Florida. Eric joined Ag Reserves in 87 before leaving to join Smithfield Foods in 1995. He came back though in 2006 to Ag Reserves as a general manager of the ranches in Florida. It's interesting when you take a look at Ag Reserves, they are really working hard to integrate sustainability initiatives throughout their operations, including a focus on efficiency, resiliency, environmental responsibility, and on their team members and communities. Our second speaker is Dr. Michael McCloskey. He's co-founder and CEO of Select Milk Producers, the sixth largest milk cooperative in the country. He's also chairman of the board for Fair Oaks Farms, the nation's largest agritourism destination, located in Northwest Indiana. Dr. McCloskey has been instrumental in creating proprietary value-added dairy products, patented milk processing and dispensing systems, which led to the creation of Fairlife, which I'm sure you've seen in your grocery stores. It's a dairy-based health and wellness company, which is now solely owned by Coca-Cola. His home farm is Curtis Creek Dairy Farms, also in Northwest Indiana, which milks 15,000 cows. The farm is recognized as being one of the leading sustainability dairies in the U.S. Eric and Mike, if I may call you by your first names, welcome. Thank you for joining us today. We just really want to have a conversation about the journeys that your two companies have been on and some of the learnings that you've had from that. Eric, is it all right if we start with you? I'd love to have you describe your sustainability story and where you've made some of the greatest progress to date.
Okay. Constance, like you said earlier, we're primarily in the cow-calf business. So people who aren't familiar with that term, it's what you consider traditional ranching. So we have kind of large landscapes of grasslands that we graze cattle on and raise calves that then go on into the supply chain into stock operations and feeding operations. And we started to, or we initiated development of a sustainability program back in 2016. And once we got the program kind of up and going, then we just tried to consistently refine it year after year after year. And our program is really kind of tied on four pillars of sustainability. And we've talked a lot about the environmental pillar today, but we also have animal handling and welfare, we've got community and workers, and we've got the economic pillar. And we think that those four pillars are critical to create that balance that you need in running a company. And I would say that over the years, one of the things that I think the program has done as far as making us better at what we do is that we've learned to, I guess, develop more balanced plans. And as time went on, we have certain processes we go through to develop strategy and to develop our long-term planning, and even the way we do our standard operating procedures. And we started to structure all those programs around these four pillars. So at first we kind of modified our strategy development template and centered it around those four pillars. Then we modified our planning templates and started centering them around those pillars. And the thing that I think has been really beneficial about that is I think as a business, we are more balanced in the approach that we have to raising cattle now. We don't just think about economic, we also think about environmental, we think about animal welfare and handling, we think about people and community. And when you stay focused on those pillars and you develop initiatives in each one, I think it helps you manage a more balanced business. So it's been a real benefit to us over the years.
Sorry, the integration across of the sustainability idea throughout your operations. Do you find that your team members really embrace that and each have ownership for some of those sustainability goals and objectives?
Yeah, they really have. A good example is we put together a team to go through and update our, we call them our SOPs or our standard operating procedures. And they came back to me with the idea of let's organize those also around these four pillars. And so what we did is we rearranged our whole operating manual around these four pillars. And it's interesting the things that you learn as you do that and you see where you have deficiencies and where you're doing okay. And so, yeah, our people have really embraced it. They understand it. And I think it's made us better at what we do.
Excellent. Mike, I'd love to turn to you at this point and have you share a little bit about the sustainability journey that you and your company have gone through and where you've seen some of that progress.
Yes, thank you. Been a great day following all the discussions. I really have enjoyed it tremendously. And I think the focus on hunger has been just phenomenal. I thought the discussions there were great, and obviously tying that to the sustainability effort and climate is where we need to go. Something that I feel that we focused on for years at Fair Oaks Farms and at our dairy farm. So, but one of the things that really has helped our particular farms has been a collaboration of the entire dairy industry through some leadership at DMI and National Milk and others. We've been able to bring the industry together through the Innovation Center of U.S. Dairy and have a full focus on this sustainability effort. So being able to have those type of resources to invest into research, in creating real science through a life cycle assessment originally that we did in 2008, 2009, and 2010 through both the University of Arkansas and University of Michigan, kind of set a baseline of truly where we were at as dairy farmers, and specifically pinpointed where the low-hanging fruit may be, where the medium challenges were, and where the very difficult challenges were, and kind of gave us a roadmap of what we needed to develop technologies, processes, and research, because there are areas that really were lacking research to be able to achieve. So as we developed that through the early, 2012 to 17, and really got our handle around it, the entire organization, the Innovation Center, got to a point where we had a full understanding of what our opportunities are in greenhouse gas emissions specifically. But, we did a lot of work on and continue to do a lot of work on water and nutrients and other issues that I'll talk about in a second. But specifically on greenhouse gas emissions, enough to be comfortable as leaders of the industry. We represent about the Innovation Center represents about 70% of the total milk production in the United States, both from a farm, but also from a processing level. So we have processors and producers or co-op leaders sitting at that table. And we reached a level of comfort that we truly understood our journey, that we were able to commit to a net zero by 2050 jointly as an industry. What's interesting when you do that, and I think this was well discussed at the table, when an industry does that and puts that much effort into understanding the journey and truly has science and technologies and processes and research in play that will continue to develop and give us answers, you get to a point that you got to hand it over to the individual co-ops, the individual brands, the individual processors. So they got to make their own commitment. So you can make a commitment as an industry, but what really truly drives that, so it's pre-competitive up to that point, and the knowledge is shared pre-competitively. But then you get to a point where if you are going to drive it home and you're going to be successful, everyone who was involved through their own businesses have to make their commitment. And those commitments don't have to be the same. It does, just so that they have the same trend, everyone may have a different way to approach it. And that's very acceptable. But at the end of the day, we know that our goal as an industry is to be at net zero by 2050. And therefore, those organizations involved in our industry have to really be the ones that drive that home. So with that said, I'll get back into my particular dairy farm now. And I've been able to take advantage of the efforts of so many people within the industry to be able to bring that information back home and focused on our area. So the way we look at a dairy farm itself, we kind of break it down into four specific areas, obviously, that have to do with greenhouse gas emissions. So we start with the crops. The crops are a big portion of our greenhouse gas emissions. It accounts for about 30 to 35% of our greenhouse gases. So we know that we need to focus on the whole crop area and what are the processes, the farming practices, the technologies that we need there. We've been defining those very well. We have a lot of great research going on that will continue to give us information on that. At the same time, there's the three others are the cow itself. So you're looking at enteric emissions of methane. So that accounts for about 30 to 35% as well of our total greenhouse gas emissions. So focusing, there's so much to be done in this arena right now. You can start thinking about feed additives and feed enhancers, right? But you can think about seeds and the value of better crop production and better seeds and better genetics that increase digestibility and obviously therefore increase productivity, but also decrease the amount of methane per unit produced. So that's very important. But also you look at the genetic potential of these cows, and there's two main ways using genomics of the cows that we're looking at. And one is that there are feed efficiency differences within our cows, and to be able to identify that genomically can have a tremendous impact on productivity and reduced methane through that product. But at the same time, from a genomics point of view, we know that there's a great difference between the amount of methane that individual cows produce. So you can have the same cow eating the same, producing the same amount, but one cow emitting, you know, quite a bit more methane than the other. So getting into that genomic selection, which, you know, we're very advanced in our semen selection in all bovines, as you probably know. So adding that to our selection will be something that's going to be occurring here in the near future. And when I talk about that, I'm thinking over the next 5 to 7 years. While feed efficiency will be, it's here already. We can already start choosing bulls on feed efficiency. So when you start adding all these things up, the forages that we feed, the grains that we feed, the two components of genetics that I shared with you, and you add on feed additives, both that will reduce directly methane, but others that will enhance the feed that we are feeding and make it more digestible. Mm-hmm. You can start thinking of animals that are producing 70% less methane. We're not there with scientific proof in this moment for me to use that, but from an additive scientific proof, if I take 40% here and 10 here and 20 here, if all that is additive, and it should be additive, that's something that we will have the metrics and be able to prove it and measure it. And I think we'll have all that within the next 5 and 7 years as well. So there's a tremendous advantage. And I think what's important about the crop side that I shared earlier, where we got about 30% and we can reduce the crops to the point where we're sequestering carbon instead of emitting any greenhouse gases. So not only eliminate them through great farming practices, but at the same time, sequester carbon on top of that. And then you take what I just shared with you on the enteric emission. This is not a thing about scale. Anyone can do this. You could do this with 100 acres and you can do this with one cow. Okay, so these are opportunities for the world, not something that you say, well, that's an American US farm, large scale farmer. Not necessarily. So it's nice that we can use all of this information and all this research and efforts, and it becomes available to all. So it was all done pre-competitive, and our goal is that everyone have access to it. The third area, obviously, is manure management. And manure management can be 25 or so percent of our methane emissions. And we have done fantastic work in this arena. At Fair Oaks, I've been involved in digester development since 2000. And produced electricity, produced fuel, developed 12-liter and 14-liter engines on with Cummins and others to be able to transport our milk, and also participate in low carbon fuel standards, selling product or gas, clean renewable natural gas into that system. So we have 100% of our cows on digesters, so we're capturing 100% of whatever that impact of the manure was within our systems. And we take that even further now. We have technology that we are separating in the manure, being able to capture 90% of the ammonia and creating an ammonia fertilizer that's organic, certified organic already. And we have a dirt creation out of that that's 90% dry matter with a great nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium profile. So basically eliminating any emissions whatsoever, even after the digester that used to exist in the lagoon, we've been able to eliminate those as well. And then just to wrap up, the fourth one would be the energy used in production, like we all do. So whatever electricity you're using, whatever fuel you use in your tractors, and all that energy input, which is a very small percentage, believe it or not, people initially, when we started the LCA, we thought that would be a bigger impact, but it's only about 10 to 12% of the total impact. And in some operations, it's as low as 8. So, but still an area that if you're producing your own electricity and you produce your own renewable natural gas and you start using those things, you eliminate that totally as well. So that's kind of the effort and the way that we break it down. Jeff says, hey, we got to keep this simple. And I believe that's the way we got to approach it. And I think if you approach it with those four, breaking the farm into those four areas and you look for the science that has been created there, that there's an opportunity for everyone to really embrace this, not only in the United States, but around the world. Thank you.
That is our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.